Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff and we are actually off this week. So instead, we have for you an interview I did with Mitchell Jackson back in 2021. Mitchell is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his Runner's World story about the murder of Ahmed Arbery, titled 12 Minutes and a Life. Read that if you haven't. He's also the author of a memoir of his life growing up in Portland called Survival Math. He's one of my favorite guests of the last few years, and I hope that if you haven't heard it already, you enjoy it. We'll be back next week with a new episode, and for now, here's myself with Mitchell Jackson last year. Mitchell, welcome to the Longform Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you coming on. We are currently at the beginning of the murder trial of the three men accused of murdering Ahmed Arbery. So I wanted to start with your Runner's World story and work backwards from there in time a little bit. First, maybe could you tell me a little bit about the origins of that story for you, sort of how it came about?
Yeah. Well, I was on a fellowship at the New York Public Library 2019. Was it in the 2020? During the pandemic, we got cut short by the pandemic, and I was researching a novel project. And once I was started sheltering, so early, like March, I decided that I wanted to write a novella-length prologue. I had read Don DeLillo's Pavco at the Wall and just was enamored by it. And it's like, okay, I'm going to do this. So I decided to dedicate my sheltering pandemic time to working on this novel or this opening. And so I did it. I was putting in like 12-hour days. I didn't leave my apartment. I was really sheltering, not like other people, like going out and coming back in. I stayed in the apartment. Anyway, so must have been a few weeks after the tape surfaced. I don't really have a writing project in front of me. Like, what am I going to do? And I picked up my phone and I had an email or a text from a guy named Ryan D'Agostino who works at Hearst. And he was like, man, I think I got an idea for you. You know, give me a call. So I called him and he was like, hey, what do you think about writing about Ahmed Arbery for Runner's World? And I paid attention, not like that much attention, but I knew enough to know that the tape had surfaced and I was outraged. But the timing of it was like, I was looking for something to really keep my mind off of doing something else, but also do something that mattered. And so I took on the project from Ryan.
And when you, I guess, sat down or connected with an editor at Runner's World, did you already have in your mind when you started kind of what you wanted to do with the piece, or did it develop through the conversations that you had?
Yeah. Well, my first question was, do I have to travel because I was sheltering? He was like, no, you don't have to. And then I was fearful because I didn't know how to write a profile or a long form piece without going to the place. I had never done that before.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why I mentioned that the novel work is because that the prologue is a story within a story. It's about the 1965 Watts Revolt, which started from a car stop. So that structure was in my head when I started the Arbery piece. So what the journalists call a TikTok was to me a story within a story. And I came to that really early on. Also because the New York Times had a video journalism piece on the what happened, and it was like a time clock. And it went, it like showed you inside of the house and showed you the route that Maude took, and that's how I knew the time frame too. So once I saw that video and then I already had that structure in my head, I was like, okay, this is it.
And there's sort of, there ends up being sort of four strands in the story. There's his story of who he was. There's the TikTok, if you want to call it that, of the crime. And then there's the history of Brunswick, Georgia.
Yeah.
And then there's the history of running and running as a sport. How did that develop that you wanted to provide those other layers of context, and how did you weave them together?
Well, I knew that I wanted the history of running because I was writing for Runner's World, and also because one of the things I'm committed to is writing about home. So once I started doing a little preliminary research and found out that running came out of Oregon, that was all I needed. So, you know, it allowed me to do the thing that I am committed to doing. Obviously, the TikTok, I didn't want people to look away. I knew some people wouldn't watch the video, you know, rightfully so. So I wanted them to know what these men did, that they hunted this man and lynched him. So it was really important to get those details. And also, because it was creative nonfiction rather than journalism, like I could try to get in Maude's head, like what might he have been thinking during this chase? That was really important to me. The thing that I didn't know that I was going to write about necessarily was the history of Brunswick. But the more I started talking to people and just thinking about how much racism is tacit, that really made me committed to also kind of framing, you know, because how can we not frame what happened to Maude outside of racism? And then clearly, you know, trying to show who he was, because I think every time a human is murdered, they immediately just become that murder. We get all the details of George Floyd's murder, but we don't necessarily get people writing about, well, who was he before this? And, you know, what was his daughter like and his friends? And I was really, really committed to that.
And then you had to reach out to, you know, his family members and friends that he grew up with.
Yeah.
And, you know, in some of these cases, it could be that they're inundated with national press constantly who want them to come on and talk about this. And then in other cases, they're weirdly overlooked and people don't actually go get their stories. And what was the situation here? How did you make that approach?
So when they reached out to me, it was two editors, Leah Flickinger and Ryan. They had already talked to Maude's coach, an old coach, Jason. Jason was the coach that started the run with Maude. And so he was already willing to talk to them. And so I thought, well, maybe Jason can connect me to some people. So I called Jason. We got on the phone and he was actually driving. So I was asking him questions and he had someone in the car with him who kept helping him answer questions. And then finally I was like, well, who is this? And it was Hakeem, who is Ahmad's best friend, was in the car when I talked to Jason. And so then I said, well, Keem, can I talk to you later? And he's like, oh, sure, man, let's make a time. Then I got on the phone with Keem. And then Keem would tell me some stories and he would say, yeah, you know, we were with Jasmine. And I'd say, well, who's Jasmine? He'd say, oh, this is Maude's sister. I'd say, well, can you connect me to her? Yeah, man, sure. Let me check it out. And then I get on the phone with Jasmine and Jasmine would say, well, it was such and such. So that's really how it happened, was one close family member or friend connecting me to the other. So I'm very, very thankful to them, because it could have just been like, no, I'll talk to you. But like, that's where this stops. But every single person I talked to was willing to connect me to someone else.
And how did those conversations go? I mean, these are people who are, I mean, the killing was in, what, February, and then the take came out in May, and then these people are still grieving.
Yeah, this is June, yeah.
But also, they've suffered this incredible injustice on top of grieving. And so what? How did you prepare to speak to them, or and how did you deal with those factors?
Yeah, well, first telling them, like, the obvious that, you know, I understand that you're grieving. Also, I was trying to explain to them my objective was not to write about necessarily Maude being murdered, but about how Maude lived and really trying to figure out who he was as a person. And just also trying to find touchstones that we share. You know, like I tell them a little bit about my story. And it was strange because the last person that I interviewed was Maude's older brother, Buck. And I remember my partner was she was in the living room while I was talking, but I had the speakerphone on so I could record. And at the end of the conversation, Buck and I were like laughing and telling jokes to each other. And I got off the phone and she was like, "Who is that?" Like, and I was like, "Oh, that was my brother." She was like, "It sounded like y'all known each other for like 15 years. It was just so natural." I really got a good feeling from everyone I talked to about, you know, they were just generous and kind and strong too, right? Because they were going through this grieving process and were still willing to talk about the thing that was making them grieve.
Yeah, and the details, I mean, some of the details in the story, did you find that they wanted to share those details because they wanted to say who this person was in their lives outside of the crime?
I think they had a comfort with me that I was not trying to exploit my story. And so when we started chatting, it felt like I was talking to a friend rather than I was interviewing someone. And, you know, we were laughing about some of the stories and I would, you know, push them a little bit for details, and they were always very forthcoming. And even in cases like follow-ups, like everyone was like, "Well, if you need more, just text me." You know, so, was it 5 candles on the cake, or was it 2, or was it chocolate cake? And they were always willing to give me the information I needed. I think also I might not have pushed for that level of detail if I didn't know that that's really what I was trying to do, was like show who he was. So I think it was in tandem, my objective plus their willingness.
There's a couple moments. I mean, there's one moment in particular that you say, basically, readers, people reading this, you break the fourth wall, essentially, and you say, "I invite you to ask yourself, you know, what is a runner's world? Like, who runs, who gets to run?"
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in who are you imagining as the readership when you're writing those lines?
People that don't look like me. I imagine, like, when I think of a runner, a jogger, someone whose identity is connected to that, I think of someone who has resources and time and enough education to know that that's an important decision for their physical health. So we're talking about middle to upper class people who are joggers. Like, you're not going to see no poor people jogging in the hood unless they boxing or, you know, like for a sport. But just recreational joggers. So it's a way of inviting them to kind of step outside of themselves and analyze just the privilege that they have just by being able to run. I actually didn't even look at the demographics of Runner's World. I just imagine, you know, like, I mean, I've done enough empirical research in different neighborhoods to know that there ain't a lot of joggers in the hood.
But the other moment I wanted to ask you about is the moment where it sort of builds to the point where you describe it as a lynching.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe other police-related killings as lynchings. And first, I'm interested in if you got any pushback on that. Like, I feel like if it was the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or something, I imagine editor pushback on that. And I'm wondering if you did get any.
I didn't get any pushback. I don't remember. If I did, I didn't. And it was also one of those things, I was pretty steadfast And it's, yeah, interesting you say that, because I just did a story for the Times maybe last month, and it was so much back and forth. I'm like, do we really got to call these people and ask them, was the bill 625 or 623 like that important? they serious.
This is where you, the story where you met up with your old friends in Las Vegas, that story?
Yeah, they was looking at receipts. I'm like, come on, man. He like, they don't have no chicken wings on the, it was barbecue. I'm like, okay, all right. They are serious.
But even from a, I think there's a certain type of media outlet that would say, well, the trial hasn't happened.
Yeah, yeah.
This hasn't been established as that. Whereas
yeah.
I think a lot of ordinary people would look at it and say, this looks like a lynching. And your choice to write that, I assume you had decided that from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't decide it from the beginning. I think had I called it a murder, there probably would have been more pushback, because now we're getting into the like hard legality of, is it a murder? They haven't been convicted. But to call it a lynching, I think it's actually a kind of, like, it's not connected necessarily to law in the way I think that me calling it a murder or homicide or whatever would be. But also, you know, the body that came up with the rubric, the NAACP, I mean, if you look at that, it actually does fit it, right? So, I mean, I guess I could have kind of hedged, like, it looks like a lynching, but I was very happy that Leah didn't strike that, because also, to me, it gives a greater sense of, like, what actually happened, right? Like, I think Ahmaud's case was significant for how different it was from the other cases. Like, if a person dies, you know, it's a terrible thing. But to hunt a person, though, like, he's running for his life for this many minutes, like, I think that was just another level of malice. And I actually don't even think murder would cover that.
Yeah. But you didn't end it on that. That was the other thing that I felt really made it powerful, is that, because that could be very naturally, that line could have been the end of the story, but you didn't.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, the objective of who is this person. So, you know, I'd done all these interviews. I had all of these anecdotes. I felt like I knew Ahmaud. And, you know, when you're a reporter, you're like, well, you got to cut something. And so I had cut everything, and I was like, I just don't want to get rid of all of this detail. And that's really, and I also really love List, and I love Anafra. And so that's where I came up with the idea, well, like, let me just make a long list of who this guy was and what I really want people to know about him before this thing ends. Yeah, and that was really important. And I think also because it was after the lynching, that I could stop time in that moment too, right? Like the forward movement of the story was stopped there, so I could just take a pause and say, all right, here's who this guy was.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
There's a moment in the story where you say you wonder why he's dead and why you're alive.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of get at that maybe as a way of going back into your story a little bit. Your book's called Survival Math. And just as a starting point, describe what that means and sort of where that came from.
So survival math, I'm from Oregon, Portland, Oregon. In my teens and early 20s, I was selling drugs. I guess the best way to describe it is like I was also a nice guy. So I think to be a successful drug dealer, you have to kind of commit to doing harm to people. And I hadn't made that commitment. And so people were robbing me and, you know, trying to run up in my house and put guns to my head and all these things. And so there was a time when a guy I knew and some other, I don't know who was with him, but it was more than one person. They tried to break into my house and they didn't get in because a neighbor called the police on them. I didn't know it was him at the time, but then I went to I was calling my OG at the time and I told him what happened and he was like, oh yeah, man, they say that was Stitches trying to get in there. They heard you had some kilograms in the house and some money and they was coming to get it. And I was like, okay, so now I'm like, okay, now I got a problem with this guy named Stitches, who was a gang member from my neighborhood. And I just so happened to be coming out of a house really early in the morning, and I saw a guy on a bicycle riding towards me in all black. He had a skull cap on. And at the time, now I'm carrying a pistol, but the gun is in my car, and I'm like fumbling for my keys. I don't know where my keys are. By the time the person gets close enough for me to realize that it's Stitches, I'm at my car door, but I still don't have my keys. So he jumps off his bike and he's like, hey man, I heard you was looking for me. And I kind of look around and he pulls out his pistol and he points it at my chest and he's like, yo, are you looking for me? And I look down the street. I'm like, damn, man, it's like 6 a.m. Ain't nobody out here. I look the other way like, man, ain't nobody out here. I'm like, man, is he going to shoot me? Like, is he going to shoot me in my chest? Is he going to shoot me in my head? Is he going to shoot me in my leg? Like, can I survive this? And then I'm thinking like, well, if I don't say nothing now and I just let him go, like if I get in my car, I got my pistol so I can like ride down the street and shoot him. But if I don't kill him, is he going to come to my mama house? He know where I live? All these things. And they're really happening in a split second. And then I say, no, I'm not looking for you. And Stitches waves his gun. He's like, yeah, yeah, because I'm a real killer. I'm a real killer. And he puts his gun in his pants and he rides off. And years later, I was reflecting on that moment and the calculations that I made between, are you looking for me? And my response, I'd say saved my life that day, because Stitches turned out to be a convicted murderer twice or three times over. And so that's where I got survival math from. The kind of on the spot calculations you make when you face a mortal threat. So really the part that connected me to Mod was reading about him. He had come home from college and he took a gun to a basketball game and someone saw it and then they ended up arresting him for it. And so that video came out after the McMichaels were arrested. And so to me, it was a direct attempt to defame Ahmad and to say like, well, maybe he deserved what happened to him. And for me, I was guilty of selling drugs. I got caught with a gun. I went to prison and it was not lost on me that here I was a professor doing okay in the world, and this young man was dead. And so I did it as a kind of shield against that kind of defamation of Ahmaud. And then also to say, like, man, he has so many more possibilities.
And the underlying assumption there is that if you had been killed at that age, in that incident or some other incident, and it became a story, people would have said, oh, he
was selling drugs.
He was asking for it.
Yeah.
I want to ask you one, like, maybe too meta question here, which is, I've heard you tell that story, and I also have read you tell that story in your book, and even in an excerpt of your book, I think in Harper's or The New Yorker, but it's still, I'm still riveted to hear you tell the story out loud. And I'm wondering how you feel when you tell the story. You lived it, you've written it, you've been asked about it by people like me many times.
Yeah.
How does it feel when you tell it?
Man, when I tell it, it doesn't feel like being there. Nothing is going to ever match actually experiencing it in the moment, but it is not, it's not lost on me. Like going to prison, sometimes I'm like, man, yeah, I was in prison. Like, that's it almost like it never happened. But that moment and a couple of other moments, I'll never forget. Like, it's a present. And because I know this guy, I know what he has done to other people. He did some crazy stuff to my brother. So, like, I realized that I was literally seconds away from not being here. It really makes me, like, it gives me a vantage on this present moment that probably very few things in my life can do.
When did writing become an ambition for you?
That is the thing that happened in prison. So I guess that makes prison most memorable, is that it was so crazy, man. I don't know if you know where waves are. Like, my hair is like laid down right now. And in prison, we had do-rags. Okay, yeah, so everybody knows what a do-rag is. So do-rags were disallowed in prison. You know, people can hang themselves, or I guess they thought maybe there'd be a weapon. So they were contraband. But somehow I got a do-rag from the outside, and I had a do-rag in prison. So someone caught me with my do-rag trying to lay my hair down. So I got put on restriction, which is like, I was in a medium security prison, so we didn't have a hole. So there, and I was in a dorm. So their version of the hole was, you're on your bunk 20 hours out the day. Like, all you could do is go down for meals, but otherwise you just got to sit on your bunk. And I was like, well, what the hell am I going to do? And I was like, I know, I'll just start writing my life story. And that's really how it happened. If not for me getting caught with a do-rag in prison, I probably never would have become a writer. And I don't think I ever said that before, because I forgot about the do-rag part.
What do you think gave you the impulse that you wanted to write down your life story?
Well, I think in prison, guys like to sensationalize their experience a lot. You know, I've been out here getting in shootouts and fighting, and that's a common kind of conversation, you know, on the yard. And one thing that I do remember about myself as a youngster is I would always journal. So I would journal about whatever experience, mainly connected to my mother and her addiction. And I forgot about it, but she actually kept some of those journals and showed them to me later.
Oh, wow.
So my impulse was not to sensationalize my life, but to make sense of, you know, my mother's experience, my brother's, what had happened to me. At the point that I was in prison, I don't know if you read Residue Years, but in Residue Years, my novel, the guy is trying to buy his old family home. And when I went to prison, my kind of plan for getting out of selling drugs was to start flipping houses, right? So I had bought a house with this white guy. He was like, he's been doing it a long time. He was going to show me how to get into business. And I had bought a house. I had paid all cash to get it remodeled. And then I get popped, and I'm going to prison, and I don't want to make the note. So he's like, okay, Mitch, look, you can sign it over to me, and I'll make the note, and then I'll sell it, and then we'll split the profits. And I'm like, okay, Terry, like, cool. That's, I don't got to make the note. Like, you know, I'm be gone for a minute. So we get in there. I get out in a month or two. I call Terry. I can't get him. You know, next month passed. I call Terry. I can't get him. Now I'm calling my girlfriend. Like, hey, like, can you call Terry and see what's up? And she can't reach him. Terry disappears. Then the house gets sold. He was supposed to give me $1,000 a month while he had it in his possession. And then when he sold it, give me the money. So he gave me like one payment. And then he didn't give me any more payments. So now I'm calling, looking after him. And then he sold the house and I never got my money. So that was heavy on me in prison because that was the money that I thought I was going to come out to in the world because I didn't have any more. So I was like, oh, there's going to be a lot more pressure on me to start selling drugs again because I'm broke when I get out of here. So that was also like, what am I going to do with my life was a part of the impetus for wanting to write too.
And you were in college when you got arrested, right?
Yeah, I was a junior at Portland State. I was on a scholarship and they held it for me. So that worked out well. But I mean, I was supporting my mom at the time. You know, I was taking care of my little brothers and to come home and to like not just to not have money, but to know that someone duped you out of the money that you were supposed to have and you were trying to do something legal. Yeah, it was crazy.
And so that first impulse, that first writing impulse was to tell your story.
Yeah.
Did that carry through as you got more interested in writing that what you wanted to do was tell the stories from your own life?
Yeah. So the first impulse was to tell my story. The next thing was you don't know how to do it. So that was the impulse to go to graduate school and to learn. I think a lot of people would just like people from back home or all over really email me all the time like, I got this book I want to write. And, you know, and the first thing I tell them was like, well, have you read a book like the one that you want to write? And then I say, do you know of any writer's workshops in your area? Because I think people just think if you have a story, then of course you can write a book. And yeah, you probably can, but it won't necessarily be good. And I was always interested in the craft. So once I decided I want to tell my story, I'm like, oh, well, my story is actually not that. It's like not very interesting, right? Like guy from the hood, mom on drugs, goes to prison. Like that's basically half the dudes in my neighborhood have that exact story. So then I was like, well, how do I make this into something that's worthy of reading? And that's where it was like, okay, you need to go to school. And then I got to Portland State and I had a thesis and I was like, this ain't it. Like, you still don't know what you're doing. And that's when I applied to go to NYU afterwards. And I finished that program. And I looked at that thesis. I'm like, this ain't it. Now I'm out. Now I've gone to graduate school twice. So I can't get in another program, but I'm still not ready. So that's where I'm like taking workshops and going to different weekends and trying to find mentorship. And I bump into Gordon Lish. So I think that was the difference was I did have an impetus to write about me, but then I married it very quickly to like wanting to learn craft.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in there Gordon Lish. And so I know that's part of your story, but tell us a little bit about what that relationship was or is.
Yeah. Well, it is nothing, but all right. If I back all the way up, there's a guy in Portland, Oregon, a writer named Tom Spanbauer. He is a cult hero in Portland. He has a workshop that he taught. I don't know if he's still doing it, but he taught out in the basement of his home for maybe 30 years. His most famous protege is Chuck Palahniuk. So Chuck Palahniuk wrote Fight Club in this workshop. So I read a story. I used to work at the Oregonian stacking papers. So I would often read the paper. And I read a story about Chuck Palahniuk who mentioned this Tom Spanbauer guy. Now, this is when I think I might be in Portland State in graduate school. So then I go to Tom and I'm like, hey, Tom, like, can I sit in on a class? And he's very generous. You had to pay to go, but he never made me pay. He would just let me sit in the class. So I sat in. And then I found out that what Tom was teaching, he called it dangerous writing. But what it was Gordon Lish's philosophies kind of repackaged because Tom was one of Gordon Lish's first students at Columbia. So I knew about Gordon Lish. And then when I was in New York all these years later, so this is probably 2001 when I'm in Tom Spanbauer's class. I moved to New York in 2002. 2008, I see that this place called the Center for Fiction is offering a workshop of Gordon Lish. He's come back to teaching after, I think, maybe a decade of not teaching. So I apply, I get in the class, and the way Gordon teaches is he basically gives you a lecture for 5 hours. It's really remarkable because the dude is like probably 70 by the time I get to him, and he never even takes like a bathroom break. Like, he just lectures for 6 hours, 5 hours. And then he says, all right, go home, use the principles I gave you, and write a sentence. If I like your first, you can write two. If I like your second, you can read three. But if I don't like your first one, that's it. And we come back the next class, and people try to read a sentence, and he's like, stop. And like, did you know that was trash? Well, why are you reading that shit in here? I'm going to die soon. And this is what you're reading in here? I remember him saying that to like the first person. I was like, oh, man, this is serious. And he got around to me. He calls me Jackson. Jackson, read a sentence. I read my first sentence. He said, go on. I read my second sentence. He said, yeah, yeah. I read my third sentence. He said, stop. The first sentence was, she told me to hold it for safekeep. The second sentence was, she told me to hold it, and then she took it back. The third sentence was, rent money from under the mattress. And when I read that, he said, stop. He was like, Jackson, don't ever ask for anyone's sympathy on the page. You hear me? Don't ever ask for anyone's sympathy. And then the next thing he said was the thing that set me free. He said, but I'll tell you one thing, Jackson, you got an ear. And once he said that, I was like, oh, wow. Like, I can hear language different than other people. Like, I can hear the word that I might not know the word, but when I see it, I know that this word goes with this word. So I really started to cultivate that. And he took an interest in me and started like working with me on short stories. But more importantly, he would like call me in the middle of the night and say like, Jackson, I think you can be great. You could go all the way. Stick with me. I'll get you there. And like send me postcards. And he told me the thing that I could do that would set me apart. And then he gave me the confidence.
Wow.
And then after my first novel came out, he just abandoned me. He's like the last time I talked to him on the phone, I was at my birthday party, actually, with the guy that I was in that class with. And I was like, have you talked to Gordon? And he was like, nah. He's like, well, let's call him. I was like, all right, cool. So I called him. Hey, Gordon. He said, hello. I said, hey, it's Mitchell. He said, Mitchell? I said, yeah, it's Mitchell Jackson. He said, Mitchell Jackson? I said, yeah. He said, click. And that was it.
What?
So Gordon is, I keep telling this story, but Gordon, he ain't messing with me.
You don't have any, has anyone told you, oh, I think it might be this? Or?
Well, he has a history of cutting off students. Some people say he has a history of cutting off students after they like achieve some kind of success, or he feels they don't need him anymore. I don't know the exact reason. I don't feel like I was successful when he cut. I mean, I had a book, but like that was it. So I don't know the reason that he's not sharing it with me, or hasn't shared it with me or anyone else I know of. But yeah, he ain't answering the phone. He'll pick it up, but if I say Mitchell, that's it.
That's so strange.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, he gave me something that just keeps giving.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, in a way, he's always with me. Literally. Like, I have the notes from his class. I revisit them. I'm always parodying something he told me in my own workshops. I have one of those voicemails saved of him, you know, I think you can be great. So, like, I didn't really lose him.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community-building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries, not including...
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
Well, one of the things in your writing, and this is particularly in Survival Math, I feel like the honesty in your telling of the story and the way you kind of turn the lens on yourself, even when you're not writing about yourself, even when you're sometimes when you're doing a celebrity profile, you fold yourself into it. Like you'll pop up certain times. I'm thinking about when you profiled, I think, Michael B. Jordan, and there was a there's a little section there about the movie Just Mercy, and there's a section about someone being strip searched in prison, and then you just have like a little paragraph that says, I know of what I speak when I talk about what it feels like to be strip searched. And is that something that comes up naturally in the course when you sit down to write?
It's an objective that I always want to do work where I feel a stake in it, a personal connection. That Michael B. Jordan piece, ironically, is the thing that led to the Arbery piece, because the guy who assigned that, Ryan D'Agostino, he read Survival Math, and then he called or emailed me, and he's like, I read this book, man. I really love your voice, and I'd love to work with you. Can we have lunch? And we had lunch. I was late, too. It was terrible. And then he's like, so what are you working on? I'm like, I'm working on this new novel. And he's like, you got some pitches? And I never have pitches. Man, I don't really have any pitches. He's like, well, what do you think about this and that? And he mentioned Steph Curry. Like, what do you think about? I was like, well, I like Steph Curry. Nothing ever came of it. Then he shot me a couple other ideas, didn't work. And then finally he says, hey, man, what do you think about writing about Michael B. Jordan for the Just Mercy film? And I used to show Bryan Stevenson's TED Talk in my class. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, this is something that I feel connected to, right? So I wasn't just writing about Michael B. Jordan being a movie star. At that point, it was like, oh, I got a stake in this. Then I watched the film, and that moment in the film where the strip search happens, I'm like, oh, I can remember this. I didn't feel any more debased than when I was in prison being strip searched. I hadn't even thought about it for so long, but it just really called up that. But the thing is, yes, always I'm trying to find the connection. Same thing, I did a story on Chris Rock, and we're sitting there talking about our daughters, and our daughters are roughly the same age. And I'm like, oh, here it is. This is the thing that's linking us. Mm-hmm. So if I can't find that, it's like, why am I doing it? Because I write so slow, I'm not going to invest all this time into making a celebrity profile that no one really cares about unless you make them care about this thing.
And what is the like young Mitchell Jackson who is, let's say, stuck on his bunk, think about the Mitchell Jackson who's sitting with Michael B. Jordan or Chris Rock and trying to figure out how to do a story about them. Like, how do you reflect on that journey?
Man, that Mitchell Jackson sitting on his bunk could not have imagined that, because all I knew at the time was Portland, Oregon. And I didn't even know, like, people still, they come to Portland, they're like, oh, I was out hiking and I went to this river, and I'm like, shit, where's that? Like, I don't even know where that is. So my sense of Portland is really myopic. So to imagine, first of all, I wasn't reading magazines, you know? So, I mean, maybe there was a sort, but I, especially in prison, I didn't have any subscriptions coming in. I wasn't reading anything really. To imagine myself in New York, I mean, I had never been to New York. I had never been to the East Coast at that time. I didn't get on a plane until I was 19. So to imagine myself as a writer, to imagine that I would be living in New York, to imagine that I would be living in New York and somehow be writing for magazines, which I never even conceived that, like, people were assigned stories. Like, in my mind, the people at the magazine would have been the people writing the stories for the magazine. Like, why would you? Why not? So I didn't have any idea of a masthead or freelance. Like, all of this stuff is foreign. So even teaching, like, I could not have imagined myself being a professor. Just how? Like, I never even went to office hours. Like, how I'm a professor? Yeah, man. So I'm out beyond. I didn't really have any big dreams other than I thought I was going to get paid for playing basketball somewhere. And once that was not a reality, there was no more dream. It was just, okay, I know I don't want to work. Maybe one day I'll get a job and I'll be making $50,000 a year and I'll be here. So that was it.
But there must have been up, and you mentioned Gordon Lish and getting the voicemails, but like up until that point, and even with the voicemails, something was driving you to keep doing this. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't financially rewarding up till those later points. So
we didn't hit the rewards for a long time. You know, I think what it was is once I figured out what a writer was, right? So when I decided to start writing Residue, like, it was like a project that I wanted to complete. I don't even know if I wanted to complete. It was a project I wanted to start. Then I figured out to complete that project, I actually had to learn how to write. But when I started to figure out that writing was something that I could be good at, possibly great, if I stuck to it, then it was like, well, how many people in their life have an opportunity to be great at something? So then it was like, okay, I'm dedicated. Like, somebody just asked me to write about The Wire. And I was like, man, it's sad. I didn't watch The Wire. But I didn't watch The Wire because I moved to New York in 2002, same year The Wire came out. And the thing that I told myself was, you were not a reader growing up. You can't have a TV. You just need to be reading and writing. So I didn't buy a TV for my first probably 6 to 8 years in New York, which is all The Wire time, right? So when everybody else is like, I don't, all them shows, Sopranos, Wire, I was not watching them because I was trying to catch up with what I knew I had missed. You know, by the time I got to New York, like, I had already been around other young people who wanted to be writers. I was starting to go to literary events. So, like, I was starting to figure out what a writer's life was. And me watching TV and listening to music was not going to get me there. And it's also the thing that I'm kind of, it's like my biggest fear is also that I haven't read enough. Like, I don't know enough about craft. So I'm always really pushing on that because I feel like I started so late, right? Like, if I started reading at probably 24 or 25. I didn't really start reading until I was 25 years old. So, like, think about all the people who, like, well, I was in my room with a flashlight, you know, in the closet since I was 10. You know, I read all the children's books, and that's not me. So now I got 25 years just to catch up to an adult reader who I'll never catch them. And so when we're talking about, like, what's the structure? I don't have 100 books that I can go, well, what's the structure of that? Or what's the structure of that? So I always feel that, man. It's very acute, like, this you're not good enough. But then there's also this thing that goes, well, look at what you've done with less. So keep going.
Well, you have just won the Pulitzer Prize pretty recently.
Yeah.
And I want to know what it was like and whether it's impacted your life in any kind of broader way beyond that day.
Man, funny thing is the Pulitzer check just came in the mail today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, literally.
Wow, you think they could get it out the door? They know who's going to win. They could just send them the day they announce it.
Yeah, I think they wanted to have a ceremony, so I don't know. We haven't got a date on the ceremony, so hopefully they have one. To put the Pulitzer in context, I have to talk about the night before, because the night before was the National Magazine Awards.
Yeah.
And it was a virtual ceremony, and I was there representing Runner's World. But and my award was last.
Yeah, they put that feature writing last.
Yeah, we're going through the whole thing, and you know, I'm like, if it don't happen, it's cool. It's you know, it's all right. We're having a good time. So I got everybody up on my screen. It's like six people. And then they're announcing the people in my category. Now, again, we're at the end of the night. I done had 2-3 glasses of wine. I'm like, shit, if I don't win, I'm going to be feeling good anyway. And they put it up and, you know, some. And then Mitchell Jackson. And they were like, and the winner is Mitchell. And I was like, oh, my God. And then I got off the phone. I got up. Well, we, you know, we celebrated and, you know, all this stuff. Then when I finished, I think he's like the head of Hearst Communications, emailed me. And he was like, Mitchell, congratulations on this award. He was like, I don't know how much you know about the National Magazine Awards. He's like, but this is our Oscar. And I was like, well, because I didn't know about the National Magazine Awards before. Like, I knew about it the year before because I had wrote a short story for the Washington Post, then that won special topics issue. So I was in that, and that was the first time that I had heard about the National Magazine Award. So like here I was 2-for-2. So when he said that, it like it put it in context. So I'm like, let me celebrate this. But that is the night before the Pulitzer. And the next day, the Pulitzer's happening. I'm like, I'm still trying to like keep my spirits high from the National Magazine Award. I'm like, let me enjoy this thing. And I couldn't take the stress of it. I said, I am going to take a nap. And it was like about 1 o'clock, 12:59. I lay down. Then my phone buzzes at like 1:02. Like, and this is strange because it's my friend who actually went to graduate school with me. His name is Tyamba Jess. He won a Pulitzer for a book called The Olio in 2015, I think. So Tyamba calls me and I'm like, strange. Like we text, but he never calls. I was like, hey man, what's up? I'm thinking something like might be wrong. He's like, hey man, I just want to say congratulations. I said, congratulations for what? He was like, man, you just won a Pulitzer. I was like, get the fuck out of here, Ty. He was like, nah, man, nah. You won a Pulitzer. I'm looking at it right here. I was like, this is crazy. I'm like, so he like, but I'm gonna let you go, man. So I hang up, but I don't believe him. I'm like, I don't know what he was watching. He could have messed something up, you know, like, you know, you remember that year in the Oscars when they gave the picture of the year? I'm like, I ain't going through that. So then I'm like, let me go online. Cause I figure if like maybe Twitter is saying something. And went on Twitter, and sure enough, it was like, Runners, I was like, oh shit. I just got up and started jumping up and down, man. Like, and I had won some stuff before, but that was like, this is crazy.
So has it in any way kind of enabled you to think about what your goals are in terms of, you know, being in the literary world?
I think a lot about legacy, which is why I think I like my output is, you know, I don't write very much. Like I haven't published very many short stories. I got 2 books. I'm working on another one. Cause I think I want people to look back on this era of writers, fiction, nonfiction, and say he was one of the most important writers of his generation. And I think it came out of that thing with Gordon, right? Like, I think you can be great, Mitch. Or what is, you know, well, what is great? Well, great isn't really sales, right? Like, no one cares what James Baldwin sold. So are you doing the important work? Which is how I kind of judge what I'll take on as a freelancer. I think the thing about the Pulitzer is it has taken pressure off of me in a sense that, like, well, that's one thing I know is, like, I could be 175 years old and they'll be like, well, in 2021, he won this thing. I might not win nothing else, and that's fine. So I think it takes the pressure off of a little bit off of legacy, but then it also is like, you don't want to be a fluke. And, you know, it opens doors, you know, like now I'm having different kind of Hollywood conversations and I'm about to join another staff as a contributing writer. So that stuff is cool. I was blessed. I was in negotiations to come to Arizona State when I won the Pulitzer. Actually, when I won the Pulitzer and the Guggenheim, I was still in negotiations. So your negotiations go differently when you win a Guggenheim and a Pulitzer a couple months apart. So I'll say that.
Okay, last question then. I mean, you write fiction, you write nonfiction, you can go back and forth between them. Now you have Hollywood conversations. Now you've got way more people coming at you to do things. So how do you keep the focus on that work that you want to do given the new range of possibilities that are in front of you?
Man, it's hard. I have to figure out a way to carve space for the thing that I want to do because, yeah, and me, it's always like chasing my legacy, right? So my thing is like, can you write a novel of big scope? It's a challenge. And for the last week, I have made sure that I touch it every day. 2 hours, 3 hours, like, I'm going to do this. Also, I have been turning down those other, you know, like, do you want to write about Herschel Walker for GQ? No, right? Because I want to write this novel, right? Because to me, it's like, well, what are people going to care about? Like, are people really going to care if I write a great essay on Herschel Walker in GQ? Maybe. But I think for me, the next thing has to be a book. Unless I get to write like a really, really long piece somewhere where I spend some months working on it and I'm talking to people about what that can look like. But yeah, man, the impactful work, not the like the other stuff. And hopefully if a Hollywood conversation comes in, I have more freedom to say no to Herschel Walker, who I used to love, by the way, until he started talking crazy last year.
I'll just say for the record, I would like to read that Mitchell Jackson, Herschel Walker profile. But
man, they called me to write Dennis Rodman. I wanted to go write Dennis Rodman. The week that I went for the 833 story, they had called me to write a profile of Dennis Rodman. They were like, he's having a party at his house. And I was like, ooh, that would be, can you imagine a party at Dennis Rodman's house? And my agent was like sober. And she was like, Mitch, you'll go to that party and catch COVID. I was like, you're right, Jen. I'm going to go ahead and go to Vegas with my homeboys.
Well, given all the constraints, I'm really glad that you took this time. I really appreciate it. It's been a great conversation, and I'll let you get back to that novel.
All right. Well, man, it was great talking to you, man.
That's it for this week's show. Thank you to Mitchell Jackson for making time for that. Thank you for listening. And I'm your co-host, Evan Ratliff. My other co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. The editor this week is Seth Kelly. Our intern is Susan Peterson. And we will be back next week.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari, W., and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.